Welcome to the Think Education podcast. I'm Chris Hill, joined by Judith Lammy. Today on our educational rambling journey, we're going to talk about a subject, I guess, dear to both of our hearts in different ways. I mean, you've got, well, we've both got professional experience with it, but you also have educational experience, right, with language. I mean, it's been part of your, I was going to say, background, despite the fact that you constantly talk about fighting against it because, you know, moving into science, being very good at maths, moving in this and this sort of language always seem to keep pulling you back. Yeah. And I mean, most of our conversations are, even though they're international education or education based, they are, I think, very firmly rooted in literature. Fiction, nonfiction, poetry. I mean, it's kind of across the scope. So what would you like to talk about today? All of your favourite words?
Yes, but not necessarily in that order. apart from the fact that clearly my future life as a truck driver was never going to take off, I tried to then move into accountancy. I don't know why either. Maybe I like green pens or pencils. but literature and language learning and teaching seems to have always been writ large. And I suppose just been thinking about this over the last week or so in particular, not least because we'd had another informal chat with Vicky Lewis the other day, and we were touching upon again, you know, the experience that she'd had at university, but you know, with regard to her German, you know, language development, and that then made me think about at schools and how we learn languages at schools, or how we used to learn languages at schools. And I know that we've touched upon this in podcasts before, and you know, useful things that you can say about things that are either under a table or on a table or next to a table or by a table or on a chair or by when ironically, if you're trying to communicate it, you would be standing there by the table anyway. You just pick the thing up, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Instead of saying the book's on the table, you just pick the book up and give it to whoever you wanted to give it to. But I suppose then it did, therefore, though, make me think about all of the other things that you do learn when it comes to languages. And then those things that you remember, particularly from, let's say, when you were at school, and I certainly find this when I was at school, even at my primary school, junior school, those kind of experiences then that you remember that clearly did have a strong impact on you just by virtue of the fact that decades later you remember them. So it must have, because there's a load of things that you don't remember.
You
know?
Yes.
I vividly remember my first trip overseas because we weren't a family that certainly could afford that ourselves, and the junior school that I was in gave an opportunity for classes, a lot of the classes, to go on this trip to Belgium. I don't know how they decided that we were all going to go to Belgium was sort of ever so slightly beyond me. We went on the ferry, which I think must have taken about 5 years. And I suppose I remember two things about it. Well, probably a few things, but two in particular. Just that the whole journey part of it, getting up, getting on the coach, getting to the ferry port. I can't even remember where the ferry port was, but that seemed to take forever. And we were still in England, you know, or the UK. And then getting on the ferry and it being, I would say, choppy, to say say the least. And then finally you do arrive where you're going to arrive to, you know. And then I just remember it just looking and seeming so exotic and so different, and just nothing that I'd ever seen either in the streets of Northampton or the exotic streets of Wishaw and Motherwell, where there's rather a lot of concrete, it has to be said. And certainly a lot of iron brew. So I do remember that sort of magical side of it. And then picture this, if you will, audience and Chris, in the midst of this, you've got, and I don't know how many, it was quite a small junior school. It wasn't everybody, it was the students from 1 year and three or four teachers with us. And everybody had to wear these bubble hats.
Yes.
And they were green because they couldn't have just been black bubble hats, could they?
No.
They were green bubble hats with a big red pom-pom on top. And, you know, on the one hand, you're thinking, keeps my head warm, fair enough. And, of course, you can't see yourself in one of these, which is always a good thing. And to be fair, the teachers wore them as well. I think probably they enjoyed wearing them slightly more than they should have, to be honest. But it was just one of those, and I suppose the thing is, when you're very young and you're in this situation, you can't see yourself in it. Now looking back, and of course these were the days when you had to take pictures and send them off, and then several weeks later you got them back and found that things hadn't worked or your thumb was in the way. But one of the teachers had taken loads of pictures, and I remember stumbling across these pictures the other day when I got back. And, you know, seeing them and thinking, what? I mean, it's almost one of those caption competitions, isn't it? What would you say for this picture? You've got all of these little kids there in these big pom-poms, you know. But it was just magical, though, pom-poms and woolly hats aside. Seeing, you know, the food that was there, listening to the people talking. Now it's probably a lot more commonplace, certainly in the UK, to hear different languages and different things, you know, around, which is great. But it was less so, to be honest, then, you know, in the 60s and 70s, they didn't get that so much. And it then made me think of those kind of experiences you have through school in particular, that although, as we've said, you know, I might have had an ambition to go down a certain route and was good at maths and things like that, you know, that those kind of experiences that just really made you either step outside your comfort zone, but actually not even as dramatic as that, just different things that you didn't even know existed. And I want to ask you in a moment, Chris, if, you know, I'm sure you would have had these, given the interesting sort of background you had as well. But another one that I certainly remember is when I went on a student exchange when I was studying then in senior school, I was studying German. Because they'd given up on me in French because I was absolutely hopeless. I love the language, but it really didn't love me and it didn't stick at all in my head. Although now I've realised that they should have just shown me lots of rugby matches with French commentary and then I'd have got very good at the French commentary. Still couldn't have had a discussion about anything else, but at least that might have clicked. But I went on a student exchange to Dierdorf and had those, you know, because we had pen pals then, you wrote to people and things like that because there wasn't anything else you could do. And then, but therefore then when you got to go and visit somebody, you'd not seen it, you know, so I'd never seen pictures of anything. I didn't know what anything was going to be like. And I just remembered almost like little snippets of the visuals coming into my head every now and then. Lots of, you know, the house had lots of wood in it, you know, and there was that kind of thing. And there was just sort of things where you think, gosh, it's so different. So I didn't have any notion of what it was going to be like before I went there, only that I had to go on a ferry again. And I wasn't desperate keen, given, you know, it wasn't like really the most successful thing the previous time. But again, because it was one of those, it was the school twinning or whatever we would call them, then the school exchange. So you would all go over together sort of en masse on a coach and then go into your separate pen pals, you know, families, and then all go back again and talk about it. And then vice versa, they would have the same coming the other way. But I just remember that, those little snippets of things. And just, I suppose, finally, just remembering how kind people were, because I think, you know, that homesickness you feel as a child the first or second time you go away, maybe when you're really little, you don't feel it so much because you don't quite know, you don't appreciate the distance and things like that. I think by the time you get to your teens, you do, don't you? And almost as soon as you get on the coach in your hometown, you're feeling a bit ill because you know you're going somewhere, you know, and I think that was something that, and I therefore then understood, you know, why they give it that term, because it is, you do actually physically feel a bit queasy every now and then, even though you might be having a good time, it's just very different. So it's just those kind of experiences that I suppose I've taken with me as I've gone through life, and if increasingly, but I suppose this again happens as you get older, the older you get, the further back you look, the more with fondness you tend to look back on it. I'm sure there were times in it when I didn't feel very fond at all. But yeah, I guess it just opened my eyes to different sorts of experiences that you could have with different people. And almost, and this is really like a big revelation, it's like there are people who are the same as you, but in a different country, who speak a different language. And you know, although I think certainly as I got a bit older at that stage, my dad had passed away, but you go somewhere and there's a family, and there might be, you know, siblings and things, and it's all a bit like you at home, and you've got houses, and it's a bit like yours, except it's completely different. And, you know, they had a dog, and you've got a cat, and it's like, gosh, these are like me, only they're in a different country, and they're speaking a different language. And, of course, the big revelation for that particular trip was that I had chocolate spread you could put in a sandwich.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a winner.
There are few things, yes, a lot of my life can be drawn back clearly to forms of chocolate, be it in bars when people are driving trucks or in sandwiches. But those little things, those things stick, don't they?
Yeah.
Literally in the case of chocolate spread.
Yeah.
So what about you, Chris? Because you've had a very interesting childhood in terms of the, you know, moving around, the studying of different languages yourself as well. Do you remember that first time when you went somewhere, you had that kind of experience?
I do. It's a little different from yours because it's funny. I was quite literally just thinking, oh yeah, the first time I went abroad was when I moved abroad. So, well, that's not actually remotely true, because I was born in what used to be West Germany and lived there for a few years, then lived in Scotland for a few years, and then was in England for sort of primary school. And then we moved to Madrid. And I remember one of my classmates' mums coming into class. So I would be maybe eight or nine. And Mrs. Wilson gave us a French lesson, you know, and we learned pomme. But that was a big deal, right? You know, when you live in a very rural English community, or a rural any community, right? That sort of level of difference was already like, oh, wow. When we moved to Madrid, I mean, that was, you know, that was in and of itself massive. I mean, we were leaving home, we were leaving school, we were leaving everything behind. Not absent, obviously, immediate family, because we moved together. But from Madrid, I remember taking on a school trip. We went to France. We went by coach, because obviously you can just drive, you know, up from Madrid. And that was, and I have very distinct memories of visiting Greece when I was in sixth form, by which point we'd returned to England. And it's interesting because the way you're describing it, I think some of that wonder goes as you get older, because the more exposure that you have, the more familiar you are with the unfamiliar, in the sense that, you know, of course it's different, you know, right? And our exposure to social media and, you know, etc., we're kind of more aware of things. Then trying to think back to that experience where you'd get on some mode of transport with no idea at all where you were going, other than maybe a name, and perhaps you'd seen it on a map, an actual physical map, right? So you might know how high it is above sea level, but you didn't really have any understanding of what the place was going to be when you got there. It's funny because I mean, I see that sort of level now through the eyes, and as much as I can, of my daughter, so that when we travel and she experiences something new. But even that, her exposure and the way she reacts to things, I think, is very different from what mine would have been at that age, just because obviously our lives and worlds have moved on. But I do remember that, you know, where you being in Greece, and we were at sort of a little resort area, and everywhere we stopped, everybody that would feed us chips, because we were an English group of English school kids, you know, sixth formers, well, English people eat chips, and so literally everybody, that was, you know, and you kind of had that, oh, great, we've got chips again, and you never really worried about it because it was kind of a comfort thing. I remember just walking, we were walking along the street, and you saw, seeing people, yeah, that's their life. They just go from here, and then they work in this shop, and but they do so by walking along this pier, and this is what they get to look at, and, you know, they walk past this, and you're just thinking, yeah, that sort of realization at that point that, you know, people go about their daily lives in massively different contexts, with kind of the same, I don't think I was, I reflected on it then, but, you know, the same sort of pressures and worries that you have just as regular people, right? But I do think that I suppose maybe my empathy or understanding of that has increased, but my wonder has gone down. And I'm not sure that, I guess that's both good and bad. But I wonder if that element of, as you said, like complete ignorance, for lack of a better word, right? Complete obliviousness to what was going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have that anymore. I don't know where I would need to go for that to be, you know, a reality. But I think it's a very life-changing thing when you're young, and it's probably the best time to do it, right? Because you're kind of absent of some preconceived notions, and you can sort of just muddle along and then sort of build that up as you go on. I was wondering, do you think they picked Belgium because they went alphabetically and Belgium was the first one in the alphabet you could get to by coach?
You know, very probably. I do also feel that somebody had given far too much thought to what the colour of the bobble hats were as well. And it was almost that might have maxed them out in terms of their level of strategic thinking when it comes to where we're going to go. Part of me thinks somebody had either won or had got somewhere a bunch of free tickets.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, to just go there and thought, well, you know, why don't we go there? I have absolutely no idea why there was that choice, but it certainly had been something that has stuck with me for decades. But something you just said there, Chris, and absolutely I'm going to be having as a little bit in our book, I'm going to be asking some of our friends and fellow writers and colleagues this very question, because it made me think of it when you said chips. Yes, we're back to the food. But because I was watching some food program, obviously, on television the other day, and it was, I think, actually, it might have even been, quick plug, but it doesn't matter, we're not on the BBC. I think it might have been Rick Stein. And he was on one of his many travels. You know, there are certain programs that are always repeated on certain channels. You know, you can always see them, and it's always Rick Stein's in Indonesia, and Rick Stein's in France, and Rick Stein's just sort of down the road, something. But, you know, and I was watching this, and he was asking the people who were there. He said, "So, what's your homesick dish?" And I thought, "Oh, that's a really good question." So I'm giving you a moment to think about this, Professor Hill. But I thought, oh, and I probably need one of those sort of smorgasbord, you know, mixing the metaphor there, of dishes going on here. I think when I was overseas and living overseas, what I really, really missed was a decent cheese and pickle sandwich. And I don't mean that kind of pickle that other people have for their own brand somewhere. And I definitely, much as I love Japan, don't mean their ginger pickle. Mm. So FYI, if you ask for a cheese and pickle sandwich in Japan, even now, I'm sure, you know, and I've been there many times since, you might find that you get something in there that you weren't entirely expecting, either a pink pickle or one of the daikons or something like that. But, you know, and basically a Branston pickle, you know, it's got to be cheddar cheese and Branston pickle in a sandwich. And that literally, when I got back, having spent those years overseas and not been able to come back, that was the first thing I had to have. I was like, I need a cheese and pickle sandwich now. And I don't know why. And it was almost, you know, you get that sensation when you're about to bite into something that where your taste buds are going absolutely mad. And you would have thought in this world of all these wonderful exotic things that that you can have, that your taste buds will be going, seriously, you know, I've just had homemade tempura made in the foots of Mount Fuji. It'd be like, yeah, you know what, taste buds are like, no, we want a cheese and pickle sandwich and we want one right now. So that, I think, was certainly that first one that I'd have. What maybe back in the day would you say was one of your homesick dishes? Bearing in mind, you have to decide where your home bit is of your story, don't you?
Yeah.
First, because it could be Itzler, or, you know, it could be tapas.
Yeah, see, I mean, that's the funny thing. It's literally, that's exactly what I was just thinking. And there's been bits and pieces. So it's often been caused by absence. So, for example, when I lived in Madrid, which was sort of through high school, this is in a time when it wasn't, the food access wasn't necessarily as international, certainly not as international as it is now. So, for example, you couldn't buy Cadbury's, right? And so that was a thing we kind of craved as kids, because you'd had it whenever you, well, not whenever you wanted, but, you know, you'd had access to it when before, and that was kind of, you know, that was missing. And then when we moved to Malaysia, you could buy Cadbury's, but Cadbury's made in different parts of the world tastes different because it's made with different ingredients. Yeah. So chocolate has always run through my life from that perspective. But actually, I mean, now it's almost a case of I miss different bits of cooking from different places that I've lived or visited, and depending on how the mood takes me. So it's strange. I don't, pickles probably quite up there as well. But now I live in a place where actually I can get, I think, almost anything I could get anywhere. And so I don't tend to have that sensation as much. I'm sure as a kid it was chips. I'm sure that must have factored in somewhere as a kid growing up. Now I think it's probably tortilla from Spain, made particularly by one of my best friend's father, which is, you know, still to this day one of the best things I've ever eaten. And when I was actually asked what would be my last meal, that's what I suggested. So that would be pretty high up on there. But that's a great question to ask.
And maybe actually, though, Chris, what you've just said there too is an important factor in a lot of people's thoughts around this, isn't it? So this might be that, you know, that final question we ask our podcast interviewees when they come on. Instead of what do you think is going to happen in higher education, we've done that. We did that last year. We've got a load of answers, and we're just going to test them on, see if they come true. But this year it is going to be, right, what's your homesick dish? But I think what you said as well, though, is that very often, of course, there is the, so for me, with the whole cheese and pickle sandwich thing, it actually was the same. It didn't matter who made it. It didn't matter where, you know, it didn't, none of that mattered at all. It simply was the taste of that food together in a sandwich. You could have given me the ingredients and I can put it together myself. But then there's that other type of homesick dish that is also, or nostalgia, or whatever, however you want to term it, that is also about who's made it, or what it tasted like, or what, as well as the actual ingredients itself, isn't it? Or it's what it, you know, what it conjures up. So you'll get a lot of people, therefore, no doubt, and often then it's puddings, isn't it? Because
well, why not?
Certainly in the UK, we do like our puddings. We'll say often in the UK it's puddings, you know. So whether you like your crumbles or your chocolate puddings, or all of these different types of things, where then because it's not sweet enough because it has 100 weight of sugar in it, you want to put cream and or ice cream on it and or custard as well. And then we go to other countries and complain and screw our noses up when it's like, oh, that's a bit sweet. And you're like, seriously?
Yeah.
You know, it's just different. But so I think certainly as well, me as of, if I think now of some of those dishes where it's less about it being something I couldn't get, because as you say, you can pretty much get everything now. Although I do think, and again, coming back to, I mentioned tempura probably for a reason, in that, you know, the first thing I have when I go to Japan is yasai tempura, vegetable tempura. I just love it.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and everybody that ever comes to Japan with me knows that. It's like, just give a, just don't bother even showing us the menu. Bring tempura, she'll be fine with the proper dipping sauce. Because I simply, even when I've been to wonderful Japanese restaurants all the way around the world, you know, there are just some little places and little back streets in Kyoto or somewhere where you'll get something like that. And it's just wonderful. And then you've got the mixture of what it makes you think about when you were in that country or all the different times you were in that country, as well as just the taste of itself. And I guess then also then thinking of the comfort side of it, certainly when I'm in the UK and it's invariably quite chilly, you know, something we used to have as children was like we call it a cheese pie, but it wasn't a cheese pie. It was basically mashed potatoes with a small amount of onion and quite a bit of cheese on the top of it. And then you had it with baked beans. This isn't anything even remotely glamorous. Yeah. In fact, it doesn't look glamorous either. And I think it's just a way of using up
All
of your potatoes that are cheap, and you know, they're in the garden, and yes, your dad's just dug up a whole hundredweight of potatoes again, and yeah, we've got cheese pie. But even now, if I'm feeling a bit, you know, or if I've got a bit of a cold or something like that, and I think, oh, maybe I'll make a cheese pie. It's never as good. It's never the same. And every time I make it, I think, I don't know why I bothered doing that. It wasn't really very good.
Yeah.
What am I doing wrong? But it's that kind of thing then that just all of a sudden makes you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Like all is well with the world because of this, I'd say, small plate of food. Usually when it comes to cheese pie and baked beans, it isn't small at all because, quite frankly, cost you threepence to make it, so everybody's eating a whole load of it.
Yeah.
But it's that sort of comfort that you have around it. And I suppose that links maybe into a future topic as well that we'll have, you know, around culture and around all those aspects of different things associated with culture. But obviously food is one of them. But this is more about comfort, more about it's great having, pushing out that comfort zone and going to all these different places. But sometimes it's really, really nice to find your comfort zone and go right to the middle of it.
Yeah.
So absolutely, you can put your arms right out and you've got nowhere near getting to the edge of it. And that's sometimes quite a nice...
Yeah.
Safe, comfortable feeling.
It's funny because you know, you're talking about the fact that it's a cheese pie, but it's not necessarily a cheese pie, it's just what we call a cheese pie, right? Because it's got a the reason I keep not that anybody can see this except you, the reason I keep looking over to my left, you're right, is because on one of my bookshelves here in my office, I have a memento that I bought on that Greek trip I was talking about. So I've had it for 30 years, perhaps, and it's a flat, golden, in quotation marks, death mask. So it's metal battered flat in the shape of, you know, what would be in this case a man's face, and it was discovered by a German archaeologist. Not this one, obviously. This is a 1 euro copy or whatever it was, but the original was discovered by a German archaeologist called Heinrich Schliemann. And when he discovered it, he said, "I have gazed upon the face of Agamemnon," because it was found in Mycenae, and it was believed to be the face mask of Agamemnon, the king, from stories like the Iliad and many others. And it's not actually Agamemnon's death mask, but we think it is. And it made me think about how sometimes when we travel, our perception of what the thing that we're looking at, or the thing that we think we've experienced, or the thing that we're, you know, we're so convinced it is one thing, when in reality it's something completely, completely different.
Yeah.
And often it doesn't matter. You know, sometimes it's simply having had the experience of something, as best as we try to understand it, or as best as we try to get to the root of it, you know, sometimes it's just accepting the thing for having had the experience and learning from it. And it was kind of an interesting metaphor, because I don't consciously think about it. It's on my shelf and I see it every time I turn, you know, in one direction, kind of as a reminder of what we think we have experienced, what we think we know. And in reality, sometimes we are a long way off the mark. So this is interesting. I've managed to potentially weave Agamemnon and cheese pie together.
I was just going to say that very thing. And this, ladies and gentlemen, well, it says a lot about Professor Hill, let's face it.
Yeah.
But this almost brings together exactly what this podcast is like. You can go in the same sentence, ladies and gentlemen, in the same sentence, in the same very sentence, from a cheese pie to Agamemnon's death mask. There's not even an and or a but in the middle of it. It actually seamlessly goes through. Somehow this is obviously going to have to be the title.
Without a doubt.
Without a shadow of a doubt. And indeed, this will be the title of a chapter somewhere in the book, because how can it not be?
Yeah.
But we will take you on a roller coaster ride from the high north of Scotland to Madrid, to all these different places around the world, and then we'll give you cheese and pickle sandwiches and cheese pies, and we'll end up with a big dollop of Agamemnon's death mask at the end of it, possibly with custard on it.
Everything
in between.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it, when you travel, that you take parts of your home with you. Some cases, as you say, for comfort, right? You know, whether we take physically, you know, clothes that we want to wear, or a favorite book, or a picture of a loved one, or you know, even just the memories, we take them with us because they're part of our shield, or our protection, or our safety net, or whatever it is. And obviously we take parts of where we come from with us in our attitudes and our interactions with other people, sometimes explicit, sometimes kind of just, you know, subconscious. We just are who we are without necessarily realizing or you know. And, you know, I think we get changed as we travel, and we've talked about that. And, you know, our comfort zone sometimes, as you say, gets expanded even without us realizing it. And we just sort of build these different bits of experiences. And it's interesting to then almost think, well, we do have an impact on other people too. You know, the people that we meet when we're away, and you know, and I'm sort of brought back to, and this is, you know, something we've written in one of our recent chapters, and it reminded very much when you were talking about, you know, the student exchange trips. There's so much kindness when you travel.
Yes.
And whether it's because people are aware that things are difficult, and, you know, people are aware that, you know, particularly kids are going to be scared or lonely, but then so are adults. Like, you know, you're traveling on a work trip, you've got your family at home, your work at home, you're away, you don't know the language, you've got all these expectations and accountability, and you know, you're trying to be professional, of course, but you're still human. And I think I've experienced more kindness and sort of basic humanity in traveling with people who are on paper completely different from me, and yet, as you say, not, you know. And I think that we've talked about this in many podcasts before. I think if we can, as professionals in international higher education, experience that, and that increases our empathy towards international students or international colleagues when we meet them in our own comfort zones. And I think it's always a very, I mean, it's, I guess refreshing seems wrong, but it's always self-affirming. It's always really nice that's kind of the default, that people are just happy to learn and interact. And I think that makes, it doesn't just balance out the difficulty of travel. I think it's an enormous positive of the travel, right? It's something to really look forward to, who you're going to meet and what you're going to learn. And yeah, I think it's a very fortunate thing we have in our world.
And as you say, that kindness, that compassion, I've experienced it myself recently. I think in the trips that certainly I've had, you know, we've talked about these, haven't we? We've talked about the trips that you've had, albeit some of them so quick that you probably couldn't fleetingly get somebody to go, oh, well done, or how are you, and you're back on the plane again. But, you know, just thinking of the people I met recently in Romania, and just how lovely they were. What a wonderful lunch we had with colleagues at the university there, you know, and just nice, kind conversations. We weren't particularly going anywhere at certain points because they weren't meant to be, because it was just about all getting to know people. And so you still have that now, don't you, when you go to places. I suppose when we look back you know, when you're younger, you, as you say, you know, you are a bit more scared. You don't really, you know, you're going back home again, and that's all right. But you still sort of don't 100% know. So that you're just a little bit more, you're a bit more nervous. You don't quite know what you're going to experience. So that kind word or thought from somebody, you know, really makes a difference. And do we appreciate it at the time? Probably not. Mm. Do we appreciate it when we look back? 100%, of course we do. And so I think it's having, you know, having that with people and sharing that and maybe then making sure that we do that ourselves when we can in certain situations. I think probably most of us would do that naturally. You don't even think that you're doing it. And that's a good thing. It means you're a decent human being. But when you are having those days where, you know, you feel as though things are getting you down a little bit, you know, you might meet somebody who's just come over, or you know, students, and when we see those all the time, you know, reflect that those individuals might not be having the best day in the world, not because of anything major that's happened, just because they're feeling a bit sad and a little bit lonely. So a smile, a cheese pie, Agamemnon's death knight, any and all of these things, you know, might put a smile on somebody's face. I mean, I'm sure I've certainly had this, Chris, in the past when I'm just as we were talking about this, I was thinking of the time when I was working at University of Birmingham, and we had a project that we were leading with the British Council in Swaziland, and we were working with the university there, helping to set up a self-access centre. And I think I have touched upon this before. And whereas, you know, now we think about all of these fancy things, technology that we could be putting into these centres, this was in the early 1990s in Swaziland, and the big deal was trying to get tables and chairs and things like that. Mm-hmm. I'd basically sit outside the bursar's office and wouldn't move till he said, yes, you can go and get that table that's in that room that nobody's using and put it in the self-access centre, you know. But I remember when I first got there, and there was a lovely family that of the head of department, the head of the English department there. And I was staying in a little flat that I had on the campus, and you'd walk up to the main campus. Somebody would always come and get me and walk with me, probably because they knew I'd get lost, even though there was just one road. Part of it also was that there's a certain amount of wildlife when it comes to Africa, obviously. I spent a lot of my time trying not to think about it, or indeed naming the various cockroaches that would come scuttling across your floor, because it was their abode rather than mine. But I remember, you know, him then saying, oh, well, you come round, meet the family. And I said, he said, come and have something to eat. I said, I'd love to. I said, I'm vegetarian, but as long as that's not a problem. And actually they were delighted because they had so many vegetables and things like that, and meat was slightly more difficult to come by then. Mm. So I think they preferred it even more. And I went there, and they just didn't, they're actually his background and his wife's background, they were from Nigeria. And they did this wonderful feast of things. And they had all of these kids running around as well. And she had one strapped on her back too, as she was doing all of the cooking. She was a lecturer there, teacher there as well. And then when they took me back to my flat at the end of having had something to eat with them, and we would do this more or less every day now. Once I'd done it once and had said yes, and, you know, I was everybody's auntie, then that's what we were doing. And she'd send me back with these mounds of extra food. In Tupperwares as well, or little bags or whatever it was. And I thought, I don't know when I'm going to eat it, because you've just fed me.
Yeah.
To, you know, there's no more that can go in, and then I'm going to see you again in the morning. But it was just so nice to be able to have that little snippet, to be part of somebody's true life as well for that period of time, you know. As again, something now that I think back on, goodness me, you know, 30 years ago, was just such a lovely thing to do. But they would have been at home thinking, well, she's here, she's on her own. You know, the electricity was, let's say, a little bit random, you know, if it connected or if it didn't, you know, certainly in the little flats that we were in. And I bought my book, but as soon as the lights sort of, it got dark, you put the candles on, as soon as, you know, then you just sort of go to bed, really. They know that you're there, you're on your own. There wasn't televisions, there wasn't anything like that. So they'd be like, well, you know, she didn't want to sit there on her own, bring her up here.
Yeah.
That's a kindness of people who are busy themselves, got families, got lots of things going on, you know, and those are the kind of things that you remember as well, don't you? And as you say, you look back as well with fondness, and at times when all times are difficult and there are challenges across the world, all the time, history only shows us that, you know, and the future will be exactly the same.
Yeah.
But every now and then you have these wonderful pockets of kindness and compassion.
Yeah.
And if it comes along with a big dollop of chocolate and or cheese pie, maybe even together, there you go, top tip, everybody go out and try it now. Then, you know, life won't be that bad.
Yeah, anybody interested in recipes, just write in and we'll see what we can do. Yeah.
Next on the podcast, next time. We'll ask them if he'll come on, I think.
Yeah, the Think Education Cookbook for International Travellers.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, pack a pot of Nutella and a thing of cheddar, some Branston, and off you go. Yeah. And a knife. Yeah. Wonderful.
A wooden one. You don't want to get caught.
No, well, yeah, of course. See, there you go. That's the experienced traveller, right? You know, yes.
That's the experienced traveller. You don't want to get hauled up to one side when you go through a metal detector.
Yes, please don't.